everybody, and welcome to the Jay Martin Show. My name is Jesse Day, and we're doing something a little bit different on the show today. I'm going to interview Jay in response to requests we've received. People want to hear Jay's thoughts on the broad economy, the commodities market, and much more. So we're going to do that. So ladies and gentlemen, introducing the CEO of Cambridge House and the host of the Jay Martin Show. Welcome to the show, your own show, Jay Martin.
Good to be here, Jesse. Thanks for making the time, buddy.
Yes, I'm happy to. And I want to get started with a bit of a broader picture of the global economy. What are you watching when it comes to the global economy? What are the challenges you're seeing and any opportunities you see as well?
Yes, yeah, certainly, man. So as you know, we chat often, Jesse. Like I tend to step back from what I call the daily noise, right? And there's headlines that hit us every single day that are super seductive, and people get really wrapped up in what happened yesterday and what might happen today and how may that impact your portfolio, all of this stuff. I work really hard to insulate myself from all of that garbage. And even though, like for example, I read Bloomberg, I enjoy Bloomberg's commentary very much. They're also in the business of finding, front page news every morning and every afternoon. And frankly speaking, there just isn't front page news every morning and every afternoon, but they're obligated to do so to fulfill their obligation to their subscribers like me. I get it. However, often I get questions from subscribers asking about like near-term interest rate implications. What are your thoughts on inflation? Are we headed for a recession? And I try to step back from all those questions and just say like, okay, as a long-term value investor, what's my time horizon? And so therefore, what are the bigger picture trends that I should pay attention to? And frankly speaking, like interest rates this quarter, they don't matter so much, right? But if you step back and look at bigger trends, that's what I try to keep my finger on the pulse of. And there's two major threads that I've been following for a few years now. And the first is, within the commodity sector, it's no secret. This is an industry that's been incredibly starved of capital. And largely that's on the back of so much hype behind growth stocks in the US, FANG stocks kind of carrying the market, and a lot of money being made there in the market over the last 10 years. And there's easy money to be made. Why would you look elsewhere? Why would you look for value? Why would you look for, undiscovered opportunities when chucking cash at the broad market's been a decent bet for the last decade? But as a consequence of that, there hasn't been a lot of cash flowing to the commodity sector. And the problem with that is that you can bet all day long on big tech, and you can bet all day long on whatever they're promising, right? Renewable energy, battery storage, smart devices, smart cities, new energy grids, like you name it, whatever it is, you need the ingredients for those things. And the ingredients are the raw materials that we build with, right? Without those, it's all false promises. And so, I've always assumed there will be a day when big tech actually becomes the lead investor in the mining industry. And we're actually beginning to see that now. There's a handful of startups from Silicon Valley and some really big companies like Cobalt Metals, right? One of the more recent unicorns out of the Silicon Valley. I mean, this is a company that's funded and founded by Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Jack Ma and Richard Branson. And they're chucking hundreds of millions of dollars into the commodity sector now because they understand they need to secure their supply of the materials they need and expedite the exploration and development process. Because, as Ross Beaty told me last year on my stage at the VRIC, we're likely not short of copper at all. We probably have more than enough. The problem is it's beneath the surface and it takes, a decade plus and tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars to get it out. So we don't have a supply problem. We have an innovation problem. We have to expedite that process and make it more cost efficient. But that hasn't happened yet. So in the interim, we do have a supply problem, a huge supply problem, right? And that's been building and compounding for a decade. But it suddenly got really hot on the back of like, call it the deglobalization trend, call it the end of the era of trust from a global economy standpoint. My whole life, your whole life, right? This has been the era of increased globalization. And if a country needed something and they had the cash or the credit to acquire it, they could from the global marketplace, whatever raw materials they sought after. There was enough trust, fragile as it might have been, to allow that marketplace to prosper and grow. And that's what allowed you and I to have, greater and greater access to a wider variety of cheaper goods. I believe that era is over now. I think that era of trust has been shattered. I think it was an anomaly in the history books. I don't think it was the mean. I think now we're going to revert to the mean, which is a bit less trust, a bit more of a fragmented global economy. And, you know, if the Ukrainian-Russian war was the big trigger point, this was already in play. And this has accelerated that the countries aren't going to share like they used to. And when you can't, when you don't share, you know, your raw materials, it just means that everybody's supply chain is suddenly really, really vulnerable. And in order to secure the raw materials that your economy is going to need, countries are becoming super, super aggressive at building new partnerships, investing capital, trying to find how they can secure the supply of the things they need. Because, you know, we're in a new era. We've watched trade wars. We've watched economic wars. We're watching a hot war. We're entering the era of commodity wars. I firmly believe this. And this will define the incoming decade, the upcoming decade. And so lots to pull on there, like lots of threads to follow, but they're all big threads. None of these are 6-month trends. None of these will evolve and mature over the course of a quarter or two. These are tectonic shifts in the way the global economy is changing. And I think on the back of that, in addition to a few things, we're going to see a return of capital from speculative growth towards long-term value and probably yield, more stable bets.
Yes, I definitely tend to agree with you there. And you say you don't pay attention to the short-term noise. Obviously, a lot of calls out there for recession. It's no secret we've lived in a debt-based fiat system for some time now. How concerned are you with the potential reckoning of that debt-based system as we see U.S. deficits balloon, government spending out of control? A lot of people, of course, in the gold bug camp point to an inevitable collapse of the system and the perhaps ideal scenario of a return to a gold standard. What are your thoughts on what is going to happen? Is this something that you block out? Is this more of they're going to keep kicking the can down the road? In the end, it doesn't affect my investment decisions right now. How do you look at that?
Yeah, there's two ways to look at that. The first is like, let's look at those, let's call them near-term questions, right? Are we headed for a recession? What's going to happen with the debt crisis? All of this stuff. The question about like hard landing, soft landing, are we in a recession? Are we headed to a recession? I encourage investors to personalize that question a little bit more. You know, US set a record for bankruptcy filings in August. You ask the owners of those companies or their employees if we're in a recession, right? They got a different answer than most other people, right? Credit card delinquency payments are reaching, they're not near all-time highs, but they're headed that direction very quickly right now. Auto loan delinquency is the same thing. But more notably, new credit applications are being rejected at a record rate. So people can no longer afford their monthly nut. They're looking to lean into more credit and they can't get access to it. So consumers are being squeezed. You ask them if we're in a recession, right? They can't afford their monthly payments and they're getting rejected for new debt access. And on the back of that, I guess I'm quite bullish on energy prices. So I think that life's going to get more expensive, not less expensive. We're seeing oil run, diesel's at all-time highs from a seasonal standpoint. I'm sure you saw this, you know, Russia's now going to be limiting the export of diesel. We're already struggling to make enough of it. This is the universal ingredient to everything. If you need to grow it, manufacture it, move it, you know, you need diesel, you need oil. So if the price of oil goes up, the price of everything goes up. And so if people are already squeezed today, it's an irrelevant question. Like, are we headed towards a recession? Most people are already in one. And for most people, it's going to get worse. And you can grab your academic textbook definition of recession, a couple quarters of consecutive negative GDP growth, or you could just say, recession feels like you can't afford anything anymore. It feels like you're getting poorer. It feels like life's getting really, really hard and uncertain. And those things are true. So, you know, are we headed for or are we in a recession? It's like, reframe that thinking a little bit. Yeah, we're there. And unfortunately, like the party's just getting started. You know, bigger picture, like US dollar dominance and, you know, return to a gold standard. I think it's important to step back and here's how I think about that. I don't know what that timing looks like, but is the US dollar like sort of in its horizon days, like in its sunset days? Like, yeah, it is. And the only reason I would say that is because the empire, the US empire is in its sunset days. And it's hard for the citizens of the existing empire to acknowledge that their empire won't last forever. I would question if the majority of the citizens of any empire have ever had that awakening. I mean, we tend to think this is the system that I was born into. It's the system that exists today. It's the system that will exist forever. But you don't have to go too far back in history to see that that puck gets passed really frequently. And just through like the last 600 years, we've seen the Portuguese Empire, Spanish Empire, the Dutch Empire, the British Empire, the American Empire. This puck gets passed frequently, you know, and often. London's still a great place to visit. When we think about like the collapse of an empire or the fall of a fiat currency, we think about like, you know, the demolished walls of a Colosseum and, you know, Rome on fire. It's like, no, London's still great. Actually, Madrid's still great. Amsterdam's still great. There's still great places to visit and they're relevant in the global economy. They're just not the superpower they once were. And so, you know, I think the US is on in the decline of its empire for sure. I don't think it's going to be the fiery collapse that most of the doom and gloom pundits predict. I don't think it's going to be as near term as those same doom and gloom pundits predict. And I would maybe caution people when it comes to doom and gloom predictions in general, that that's a really seductive business model. Because if I'm calling for an end of the world scenario, whether that's broad equities market, US dollar, global economy, you name it, if I'm calling for that, that systemic crash, I've got your attention because that's a terrifying situation. But the thing about that business is you never actually have to be right. And look at the individuals in that business who are constantly calling for that crash. I mean, how many times has Harry Dent called for a crash? Like twice per month, right? This is the one, it's coming. And people just forgive him and move on, you know? But eventually he'll be right. And then he'll be heralded as his oracle who saw it coming, you know? And I'll make a movie about it. I mean, that's kind of what happens, right? Like Michael Burry has called for dozens of crashes. One materialized, and, you know, they make a movie about him. And this is kind of that business. Like it's good business if you're in the media sector to be calling for collapses. It doesn't make it real or it doesn't make your predictions valid. So I would just say step back and look at history. And what does history tell you? And history tells you that, yeah, we're probably on the downslope. And that's because every one of those empires that I already mentioned followed the same blueprint, the exact same blueprint. They became highly productive. That productivity fueled wealth creation. The wealth creation fueled decadence, more decadent lifestyle. That decadent lifestyle fueled debt obligations, and those debt obligations fueled decline. And that happened every single time, right? Productivity fuels wealth, wealth fuels decadence, decadence fuels debt, debt fuels decline. And you tell me, where are we at in that cycle in the American empire? Like it's quite clear, right? Debt is fueling decline right now. I mean, you just said it, right? And so, you know, how do you prepare for that as an investor? Yeah, you know, I carry a lot of options in physical metal. I have an abandoned fiat currency. It's the currency of, I got three kids. I got payment obligations every month. Like I'm, you know, I hold a lot of cash actually. And in the event of some liquidity crisis, like a broad equity collapse, everything gets sold off, right? In those events and things are very, very cheap. And so, you know, if you think the broad equities market, if you think there's going to be these big crashes coming in the near term, the smartest thing you can do is hold cash. That's what I think, you know, and then from a longer term standpoint, it's like, you know, my moats are things like gold and Bitcoin. You know, I'm probably a bit overweight property right now, to be honest with you. We can talk about that, but those are some thoughts I'd share, Jesse.
Right. Yeah, I definitely want to dive into physical gold a little bit later. I agree with you on cash, especially when you're getting paid 5%+ on T-bills. You can just hold them short term, roll them over. That's what I've been doing recently. You mentioned a few different geopolitical points when it came to the commodities trade. So I wanted to ask first, why should investors in the commodity space pay attention to geopolitics? And what are the main threads and trends you're seeing at the moment when it comes to the geopolitical chessboard and its potential impact on the commodity space?
So two things. Number one is the restrictive nature with which we will share these raw materials moving forward. And when you restrict the supply of anything, the value of that supply goes up. And that is being recognized right now globally. And you look at the energy wars being kind of led by Russia. I mean, that's their true reserve currency is energy, right? It's not the ruble. And they're weaponizing that as they need to and as they should. Their country's got is back against the wall. I'm not justifying the war or anything. I'm not talking about that. Just real politic. That's what they're going to do. That's their currency. They're going to weaponize it. And they have. And they're striking very interesting deals with China to sell natural gas, for example, at half the price they'll be selling to Europe this winter. You know, they're looking to stick it to Europe, stick it to the US by consequence and all of this stuff. And so, you know, in this fragmented geopolitical landscape, the chessboard's been shaken up. We don't know how the pieces will fall. But, you know, one indicator that is worth maybe mentioning is, you know, within the UN, they voted a couple of times on whether or not to condemn Russia's invasion of Ukraine. They voted in 22, they voted again in 2023, and it's usually split like 141 countries voted to condemn, 38 either abstained or voted not to condemn. And you could look at that and say, oh, they're making a call on the merits of this war. But in reality, I'd say it's a proxy vote. Countries are pledging their allegiance to the US or China. I wouldn't go so far as to say what I've heard some of my guests say is that the Russia-Ukrainian war is really a proxy war between the US and China. I wouldn't go that far. But I think that vote is a proxy vote between countries who are saying, I mean, they're watching what you and I are discussing. They're watching the baton about to be passed. And they're curious, when is that pass going to occur and who's it going to go to? And so who do I want to be loyal to right now? And, you know, I think out of that 38 that abstained or said no, it was 31 that actually abstained. It just said, we're not quite ready to cast our cards here yet, you know, and not insignificant countries either, you know, like Saudi Arabia, you know, significant countries who are just saying, we're going to let you wine and dine us. You know, we need to be swayed here, right? East or West. And so, you know, when that fragmentation happens, the value of raw materials goes up. It's worth watching for that reason, because scarcity breeds value. And that's a core part of my thesis on the commodity sector right now. But in it, you know, when it comes to consumption, there's a lot of content out there that will make an argument that in some kind of a globally coordinated recession, demand destruction will occur to an extent that prices will fall. And again, I do my best to step back from those headlines and look at history and say, what could we learn here? And if you look at, for example, global oil consumption, you know, over the last 15 years. So let's look at 2020. We actually locked the entire world in their houses. We put cars in the garage. We shuttered hotels. Airplanes were landed. Trains weren't moving. We turned off the economy. You would think that oil consumption maybe dropped by 50%, right? It dropped by 8% just during that year, single digit, just during that year, and bounced back right away in 2021. And if you go back further to the 2008 great financial crisis, like the financial crisis of my lifetime, right? Global financial crisis. Global oil consumption dropped by less than 1% during 2008. If you look at the 20-year chart, you don't even notice it. 2009 was right back on track, up and to the right. And so we get hit, but we don't stay down. And this is, again, it comes back to like us focusing on short-term, frankly, short-term events. 2008 was a short-term event in the grand trend of human innovation and progress, right? And it will always be. And so we see these volatile moments, but they're just seasons, right? Humans will continue to innovate, will continue to grow, right? We'll continue to want stuff. Demand's not going anywhere. And I only say that with conviction because I look at previous experiences where we should have assumed demand really evaporated, and it doesn't. You know, it doesn't nearly to the extent that we assume it will. And so it's easy to paint that picture and say, oh, broad equities collapse, you know, major recession coming, demand destruction, prices are going to fall. It's like, okay, well, show me that example then, if you're so confident. Because I agree, logically, that makes sense. When we look at the track record, that never happens. So it's like, all right, again, step back from the near-term headlines, look at history, the bigger trends, of what can you learn from that? And that's what I see.
Well, let's circle back to physical metals. I'd like to know why you think holding gold is important. Do you also believe in holding physical silver, and how do you differentiate them? And just as an aside to that, you also mentioned real estate, that you're overweight real estate at the moment. So what's the reason for that, and how do you approach that market?
Yeah, I'll start with real estate because it'll be the quickest bit here, Jesse. It's real simple, man. We spoke a lot about major empires over the last 500-600 years. If you look at the bloodlines that retained wealth generation after generation, historically, they've always been landowners, you know, and there's a part of my primitive mind that's like, I got three kids, you know, I want to make sure I'm building some kind of generational wealth that will survive the times. Having said that, despite my big picture, I feel pretty insecure about my real estate holdings right now. I feel a bit overexposed and I think I'm in great locations. Having said that, I'm not adding to real estate right now. I feel like I'm a bit overexposed. I'm not selling, but because again, it's like interest rates will stay high for longer than people think they will. I think a lot of recent home buyers are going to get squeezed out of their houses. In 2022, something like 70% of new mortgages in Canada were variable rate. Those numbers are going up. People typically buy houses they can barely afford, just as a common theme. That's generally the practice. So that's going to get harder. And we may see a massive real estate correction. But if my time horizon is 25, 30 years, you know, I live very close to Vancouver, British Columbia. And I was attending some meetings a couple of weeks ago for some provincial premier candidates, right? And they were pitching, you know, as they do. And every single candidate took the stage and presented how they were so focused on the housing crisis in Vancouver and how they were going to solve it. And everyone's nodding their heads in agreement, like, yeah, we need to fix the housing crisis, not enough housing, you know? And I'm just sitting there, I'm the one person shaking my head saying, what are you all talking about? Why are we acting surprised that Vancouver real estate is really, really expensive? Like, stick your head out a window. It's beautiful in every direction and the whole world can move here. Plus, it's practically an island. There's water on three sides of it. So like, what did you think was going to happen? And again, you can find those doom and gloom real estate headlines for Vancouver, British Columbia, going back to the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s and in the 2000s. So you know, I'll use that as my base case. Like, yeah, there's going to be volatility in the near term. I believe that, but what's my time horizon? And that gives me comfort. It's like, all right. So, you know, that's how I think about my real estate portfolio. I'm not looking inside Canada anymore. My family holds passports to Canada and the US. We are looking at a couple of US cities, but simultaneously, you know, we could talk about Canada in general. We're also putting down roots in Southeast Asia right now, sort of aggressively. We're going back in February and just trying to build a foundation of optionality right now. So we can talk about that. And when it comes to gold, it's, you know, again, it seems like everything I think about within my portfolio comes back to history. And it is the one asset that has stood the test of time through the rise and fall of hundreds of empires and thousands of market cycles. And when I say stood the test of time, I just mean retained its purchasing power. You know, that's what it's done. So I keep a lot of my savings, not all, but a lot of my savings in physical gold. I also take possession of that gold. I like to have it in my possession. I'm just old school and a bit primitive that way, you know? And, you know, but it does have utility. And a couple of years ago, I actually engaged in a real estate transaction that was quite expeditious and it closed a lot faster than I thought it would. I made an offer, lowball offer on a place because I knew a buyer that was quite squeezed and in distress. And so I moved in. It was a little predatory, made him a lowball offer. My real estate agent said, nobody accepts under asking offers in this town. And I said, put it through. He accepted within 2 hours. Clearly, I should have been more aggressive. But as a consequence of the expeditious close, I found myself squeezed on liquidity. And so I had to hit my gold storage and I had to liquidate some ounces. And I approached it like I was applying for a loan from the Bank of Jay and wrote myself a full promissory note, said I'm borrowing X number of ounces. They are to be paid back on this date in addition to a fee of X number of ounces. So the loan was written in number of ounces, not in dollars. And the fee was in number of ounces, not in interest. And, you know, it worked out. I mean, I felt quite vulnerable actually during that term. It was a 6-month term that I wrote myself a loan because my biggest fear was that the gold market was going to take off and I'd be stuck paying back ounces in dollars that were, you know, worth a lot more in dollars than when I borrowed them, right? Which inspired me to pay the loan back ahead of schedule. And, you know, ended up amplifying my savings rate because I'll buy gold every quarter. But, you know, because of this loan, I had to buy my quarterly gold allocation plus the fee. So it amplified my savings rate. And at the end of the day, it kind of empowered me, right? It was like, oh, you can actually be your own bank. And friends would look at that and say, why would you put yourself through the headache of having to liquidate gold and get cash? And like, if you just kept your savings in cash, you could have just, it would have been the same, right? You would have just been able to close on the deal a lot faster. And I'm like, that's the point. Like, it's a filter, right? I need that critical step to slow me down from pulling the trigger too fast. I got to think more critically about the decision if I have to go through those steps. So for somebody like me who likes to, you know, ready, fire, and then aim, it's actually a good protective measure.
And what about silver? Do you hold physical silver as well? Do you see that as more of a speculative asset as opposed to gold and sound money? Do you look at it as more of an industrial commodity? How do you approach silver?
Yeah, I do hold silver as well. Frankly, not as much just due to the volume component, because I like to take possession. And so as a consequence of that, you know, if you're taking possession of your metal, you have to think really, really critically about where you're going to store it. Do you trust that organization or person? What does the security look like? There's a lot of thought to consider there, because it takes it back to like a problem of personal sovereignty. You're now responsible for your wealth. There's no insurance policy. A bank's not going to recoup you in the event of a scam, right? So it makes it pretty real and kind of old school in that regard. And so you have to factor that stuff in. If somebody were to rob your gold, you know, it's just gone, right? Unless there's obviously lots of professional vaulting companies and all that. I'm a bit more primitive than that. So I mainly hold gold. I like silver for the torque though. And when it comes to the equities market, I'm in gold and silver for sure. Silver market's a lot more complex, as you know. It's a lot smaller than gold, but a lot more variables, because it's got the monetary demand plus the industrial demand. So two sticks in there, but I do invest in both.
Well, let's shift to equities and where you're deploying capital at the moment. You treat gold obviously as kind of a safe haven asset. Same with Bitcoin, I imagine. When it comes to maybe the speculative part of your portfolio, where do you generally deploy capital? Is it in the junior mining space? Do you look to developers, to big producers, ETFs? How do you approach the mining sector?
Yeah, so I look at quite early stage mining companies if we're looking at the commodity sector equities, Jesse, and it all comes down to like, where do I have a distinct competitive advantage? That's where I want to play with my capital. If I'm putting cash to work, it's like you're sending soldiers to war, and you want to make sure that you've assessed the landscape and know you have some sort of a competitive advantage here. So as a consequence, I don't hit, you know, broad equities market in the US, because what do I know that the other million investors don't, right? The reason I like the early stage mining sector is because my network there is exceptional, and I've spent 15 years in that business understanding, if I'm going to play that game, what part of it can I play better than anybody else? Because I'm not a geologist, I'm not a mining engineer, I'm not a technical analyst, so I can't compete in those worlds. So where can I compete? Well, I'm in the people business. I talk to people for a living. Do my podcast, YouTube channel, conference, just living on House Street, which is the sort of the home of junior mining finance for the last decade. I know the people in that business, and I've become very good at reading people. And so that's great, because at that level, you're really just investing in the intelligence, decision-making, and integrity of like one or two human beings. Early stage commodity companies, we're talking about mineral exploration or small companies. And so you're investing in the discretion of like one or two brains. You want to know before you let that human being have the adventure with your capital, like, do you trust them? And not just do you trust them to do what they say they're going to do, but do you trust them to surround themselves with other brilliant people who fill in their gaps, right? Like, as an entrepreneur, I'm quite reckless. I like to swing really hard at big things, and I'm okay. I have a high pain tolerance, so I can deal with that. But that's not a great mindset to take into being an investor, because investors should be more critical. They should be saying no more than saying yes. And so I have a little syndicate that I look at deals with together, and I intentionally build in individuals who are much more skeptical than I am. So I've filled in my weak spots with people who are strong there. And simultaneously, I'm brave where they're not, you know? And so it's a good dynamic. You want to see the same thing in your management teams. So whoever's leading these companies, you want to look at them and say, you know, first of all, if you're really exceptional, you should be surrounded by other exceptional people on your board and in your shareholder base. And is that the case? Do I recognize these names? You know, the nice thing about doing diligence on humans is you can look at their resumes and say, okay, you've led two or three companies previous. What happened to those? Right? Did your shareholders make any money? And success tends to beget success. And I'd rather pay a premium to invest in an early stage company led by an entrepreneur who's already sold three companies. So, you know, his shares are more expensive, but you got the security of experience, track record, network, and all that stuff. And toughness, man, because you know, like, plan A and plan B are going to fail in this business, in any startup business. I invest in startup tech as well. Plan A, plan B, and maybe plan C are going to fail. So does this entrepreneur, have the durability, right, to step up with plan D, you know, and keep swinging? Do they have that resilience? It's very, very, very important. And so that's my qualifier. And I get crap sometimes from, you know, mutual friends of ours, like Brent Cook, for example. He's a rock guy, you know, and he's like, you're missing a lot of the story here with your approach. And I'm saying, no, I'm playing my hand, man. This is the hand that I can play better than you can. You can play your hand better than I can, but this is my hand and I play it, right? And so, you know, I think it's very important for investors to understand what kind of investor they are. It's the most important question, and most never ask it. They just jump in and start putting cash to work, you know, and following their friends or following trends or following sentiment. But if you haven't determined what kind of investor you are, you're going to get burned. It's a tough business. And step one to figuring that out is like, how much time do you have to invest in being an investor? Right? Because that'll tell you, if you got an hour a week, like, that'll tell you some things. You should probably stick to very passive investing, right? Stick to ETFs, stick to trend plays, all this stuff. If you have 4 hours a day, you got a lot more time to play with. But the question isn't how much time do you have today? It's how much time do you have every day, this week and this month and this year? Because investing cash is like anything. The results compound over time, but you have to be disciplined and dedicated. You know, you don't hit the gym today and get jacked tomorrow. You don't spend 4 hours on your portfolio today and get rich tomorrow. Too many investors think that's the way the market works, but it's not a get rich fast scheme. It's a go broke fast scheme if you approach it that way. If you approach it properly, it's a get rich slow scheme, right? But step one is like, what kind of investor am I, right? And where's my competitive advantage? Because, you know, it's a market, and people don't think about equities like they should, in that it's a market. And if you're buying shares in a company, it means that you're having a disagreement with somebody. And like, if I'm buying shares in Tesla, for example, I'm making a decision that I think those shares are undervalued and they're going to go up. But for me to buy them, somebody has to sell them to me. There's two sides of the transactions. That means there's somebody else who's saying, I think they're overvalued and the price can go down. So if you're having that disagreement, you need to be able to ask yourself, what do I know that that person doesn't? And if I can't answer that question, keep your cash in your pocket. Catch the next bus. There's a new one every 15 minutes, right? But people will just pile in too enthusiastically without asking those critical questions. So bringing this down to my portfolio today, I'm investing in early stage junior mining companies. I'm investing in mid-tier gold producers who are cash flowing with great management. And I'm buying that sector right now because it's incredibly hated and nobody cares. As a consequence, you have great companies run by entrepreneurs with a couple successes, good assets and good jurisdictions. And you have shareholders that bought in 2020, 2021, and the price got clipped by 30%, and 2022 got clipped by 70% in 2023. And they've been holding on because nobody wants to take a loss. But now consumers are squeezed. People need cash. They can't get credit. So they're looking for liquidity at any price. And they're going to take that 80% haircut that they wouldn't take a year ago, but they'll take it today. And that is your and my opportunity. And that's the disagreement that I'm okay with. I know why they're selling. I know the motivation. So yes, I feel like I know something they don't. And that gives me the confidence to move in and be the contrarian in that market right now.
Well, that's a perfect segue into discussing a new course you've developed specifically on investing in the commodities space called the Commodity University. Tell us what that is all about and what investors can expect from the course.
Yeah, man, I'm super jacked on this, Jesse. As you know, man, we talk about it a lot. And I think this is an invaluable tool for investors who want to begin to understand the commodities industry, because there's a lot of moving parts. And we built this course, you know, in response to the hundreds of comments, questions, feedback on our show floor at the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference from people asking, how do I get started? New investors showing up, watching the same trends that you and I are talking about, and understanding there's value in the commodities business, but they don't know where to begin. And there's 100 different ways to begin, and they're all right, depending on who you are. So what we did is we built the Commodities 101. This is like foundational knowledge and expertise to understand basic supply and demand dynamics, risk factors, and how to build a portfolio. So chapter one really is that basic. It's like, what is a commodity? You know, and then we get into basic global factors that influence supply and demand and the prices of commodities focused on the metals. We do deep dives into gold, silver, copper, uranium, and energy metals to give people a sort of foundational understanding of those. And we wrap up with risk management and portfolio construction. And I'm super jacked, man. This is the resource that I wish I had 12, 15 years ago when I got into this business. Anybody who's interested, it's at thecommodityuniversity.com. Made it real simple. You can check it out today. And I love it. I'm super pumped. You'll learn from me and like a dozen other experts that are sharing their experience in the sector. And it was super fun to produce. I'm really proud of it, actually.
Yeah, I have been following it since you've been developing it, as I am a Cambridge House employee. So I've had the unique benefit of being able to see these courses before they're released to the public. And I was absolutely blown away. This is something that when I first started my journey in commodities investing, I wish was out there. So definitely can't say enough praise about the course. And as you mentioned, thecommodityuniversity.com. So we will put a link in the description below for anybody who wants to check that out. Jay, it's been a ton of fun chatting with you and hope to do it again soon.
Let's do it, man. Appreciate it, Jesse. If you enjoy my content, do me a favor. Follow or subscribe to this podcast. Drop me a rating and a review and share this with a friend. All of these things allow me to get bigger and better guests on the show. Now you can catch me all over social media at JMartinBC. Thanks for tuning in.